everybody. Welcome to TL's Roadhouse. Special guest, Mr. Brantley Gilbert in the house, son.
Oh, brother, good Hello, to see man. You.
Good to see him. I've really been looking forward to this. We've kind of met in passing a couple of times, but you and I have never had a chance to sit down and talk, and you're a pretty interesting cat, man.
I appreciate it. I think that is a
compliment. I think musically and just the journey that you've been on, I mean, it's been pretty impressive, man. You've kind of made your own mark, done your own thing. You're about the only guy I know in country that's carrying a double kick drum drummer out on the road. Is he doing it? Oh, yeah.
He is.
Yeah.
He's a trip, man. And I got to tell you, it's an honor to be here. Man, I've been a fan for as long as I can remember. So I appreciate you having me, man. I've been looking forward to it, too.
Absolutely, man. You know, there's so many people in the industry that, you know, everybody's found kind of their own path. And I think that's one of the greatest things about country music is that it's kind of the melting pot of a little bit of everything. In my era, man, it was Western swing and shuffles with a little bit of jazz and blues. And now as we've moved into the last, you know, 10, 20 years or so, it's blossomed into rap influence and hip hop influence and all these other things, man. It's pretty fascinating to see guys like Jelly Roll have success that they have had that you know, if you go back 20 years, would he have even had a chance of getting a record deal in the 90s?
Oh, no, they'd have run him out.
No way, man. You know, and guys like Colt Ford, which I've had on the show, I love Colt, man. So it's pretty amazing that guys can come in. I think the talent, as long as you've got the talent and the passion, that to me is the most important thing, and what you do, the rest of it, what you do with it, man. That's all up to you, and what your vision of what music is, and being satisfied with yourself, man.
Absolutely,
that's pretty freaking cool.
I've always felt like, man, you know, when it comes to country music, like I don't know that there's a PhD or anybody that could define actually what it is. To me, it was always, you know, I always felt like songs that I wrote were country because that's the only life I knew. I've never written a song about something I didn't understand or been through, so they all ended up country, you know, to me. But like you said, I respect somebody's passion and you know, the want to do something like that. You mentioned Colt and Jelly Roll. You know, you run into a lot of people saying, you know, this rap and country, them boys ain't country, this, that, and other. I can promise you, I should probably ask him before I tell this story, but I won't. Just to defend Jelly Roll, you know, this guy, we were shooting a music video for Son of the Dirty South.
Yeah.
And he needed to excuse himself, and there wasn't a bathroom on the premises. So this jerker stacked up like three spare tires and shit in the woods. I'm telling you, if that ain't country.
I'll kiss your ass.
Kiss your ass, you know what I'm saying? And Colt goes without saying, you know, he grew up right there by me. And I got to say, man, Colt's one of those that, if it weren't for guys like that kicking down the door, you know, would you see a Jelly Roll? You know, would you see a lot of guys that you've seen in the business? Had it not been for Colt being told no so many times, I don't know that any, you know, a lot of these guys would have gotten a yes, me included.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me, too. A lot of guys, I didn't go the independent route. I mean, I kind of fell into that at the end of, after my record label time. A lot of these guys have had massive success independently, I mean, with social media and kind of blossomed that into record deals. I mean, it's kind of been a backward path than the way we experienced things years ago. The whole music industry's changed. It's completely different than it was when I first started out. Well, how did you get your record deal?
Man, honestly, so I started out with playing shows with, you know, at first it was this little cover band that I met up with in my hometown. I told my parents I was out playing, you know, Christian conventions and stuff, and I'd go out and play with him. And when they'd take a set break, you know, it was one of those bands that played for like 5-6 hours.
Yeah.
They'd take a break, and I'd play some of my songs. Well, when around the age I was 16 or 17, I met a guy named Corey Smith in my hometown, and he'll forever be, you know, one of my main influences in songwriting. Between him and Skinner, they showed me it was all right to write about home. And, you know, that even though you write about things that are close to the chest, and it's especially for him, you know, he was writing about my home. We're from the same place.
Yeah.
I remember hearing those songs and being like, man, that resonates on another level. You know, and he's just a special guy. I ran into him. I was in the process of getting kicked out of the first bar we ever had in my town. You know, after they allowed us to build a bar, you know, I was on my way to get kicked out. And, again, I was 16, so I didn't have any business in there. And I went and toured, you know, college markets with him. He kept me from getting kicked out that night, let me play a couple songs. And, you know, I'll forever love and appreciate Corey, man. It's, I don't know if you've been exposed to him much.
I haven't.
He's an amazing guy, man. He really is. He's just a special cat. But he kind of took me around and started playing college markets. And to be honest with you, I never saw music. I didn't think he'd be something, you know, I blew up at. I didn't think I'd be on a national stage. And,
yeah.
You know, but he showed me that. I remember the day he was able to quit his job teaching and do music full time. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. You mean I don't have to do illegal shit to make ends meet? I can do music. You mean, all right, let's do it. You know,
you mean stealing hubcaps?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Spare tires, things nobody needed, you know. but yeah, I remember that and having the idea like, man, if I could sell out. And he had this goal. He was like, he wanted to sell out the Georgia Theater, which is 20 minutes from our house. And you know, it's right there where the University of Georgia is.
Yep.
And I think back then it held a little more than, or now it holds a little more than it did back then. I think it was like 600, 700 cap. And I remember when he did it, and it was such a moment of pride for him, and it kind of became a dream of mine. And, you know, I didn't see it happening anytime soon. It happened a lot sooner than I imagined. And, you know, from there, we kind of started branching out and hitting some of the same markets that we'd hit with him acoustically with a band. It's always felt like our sound was more, you know, it's just, I wanted a little more, you know what I mean? I wanted to play a rock show.
Yeah.
You know, so we'd circle back with a band and, you know, through the years, it was kind of more about being self-sustainable and kind of not being in a situation where anybody could tell me no, you know, and kind of doing everything on our terms. And I made a kind of deal within myself that I was like, I'm not playing Nashville until I know I can sell the son of a bitch out. And when I go play, when I play Nashville, I want to be an independent artist. I want to show up and I want to sell something out. And if somebody wants to come see us, we're not doing a showcase, they can come to that show.
Gotcha.
And we went to the Exit Inn and sold it out. And I'll never forget that. It was something I'll never forget. And then after that, Scott Borchetta was at that show. We had a distribution deal at the time with Average Joe's Colts label. Scott Borchetta came to that show and checked it out, and he came to the bus afterwards and, you know, offered us a deal. And I was obviously kind of standoffish, just because I'd heard horror stories about, you know, record deals and this, that, and the other. So, and I wasn't really practiced up on any of it. I didn't know any of the legal verbiage and any of that. So the first thing I did before I really hired a true manager was hired a business manager.
Probably a good thing, right?
Yeah,
there.
So, like, I don't want to blow all my money. I've never had money before. What do you do with it? So yeah, we signed a deal. We ended up working out a deal with him, and man, I've been with him ever since. It'll be, you know, 14 years next year.
I had the opportunity to spend some time with Borchetta when he was over at DreamWorks. You know, my time with Stroud over there. Scott's one of the most brilliant record people that I ever met. And the man, when it came to working a song at radio, there was nobody any better than him. His relationship and his knowledge of the business and his sense of timing about, you know, what you needed to release and when you needed to release it and how it fit in. I mean, he's one of those guys that was really brilliant at what he did.
I agree. And you know, coming from a promoting background doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, but he's also one of those guys that if you get a little sideways with him, he can kill your record faster than anybody in town.
You mean, shit. I tell you, I just had a recent experience. I got told no for the first time in 13 years. There was a song that I was working on with a guy named Adam Calhoun and a guy named Tom McDonald. And it was called Your America. I was really excited about it. It was, you know, it said some things that that I level with, and, you know, they're like-minded dudes. And it just, I mean, in hindsight, looking back at it, I get their point. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, at the current climate of society, it was something I was not ashamed at all to be a part of.
Yeah, that's pretty frustrating as an artist when you get your hand slapped like that, too. I mean, it's that's one of the bad things about being on a major label, and especially with the climate out there right now, with all the woke culture and all that crap going on, man. Yeah. You know, corporations have taken over the freaking world, you know, I know the thing, the whole Bud Light deal, man, watching all that crap go down, it just pisses you off. It's like, when is this going to come to an end? When are people going to have enough with what they see out there? And having your voice squished. But, I mean, I see so much of it going on around. I mean, look at the NFL, man. They have those guys so clamped down. If you play in the NFL, you can't say anything. Yeah. You're forced to brand the products that they tell you. I mean, you can't wear Beats. You got to wear a certain kind of headphone. I mean, they're very heavy-handed. I haven't been on a major in so long. Is it similar to that at this point?
I can honestly say my experience there with him, with that label, has always been more of a partnership than it has been an employer-employee relationship. This was the first time that legitimately in 13 years.
Things are awful polarizing out there right now, you know, and we all have very strong opinions. And I can see, as somebody that's run a small business and been on the other side of it, trying to figure out how to straddle the fence, sometimes you have to kind of step back and take a look at the bigger picture and kind of figure out what is the best thing in the interest of your career. And as an artist, that's really hard to do when you feel like your voice and your music and the lyrics and the things that you say are part of who you are, and you're very proud of that. I respect that a lot. But it's a tough fence to straddle.
For sure. For sure. And I guess that's why we have people in place to help us do that. I was all in on it. And to be honest with you, I mean, they probably wouldn't appreciate me saying this, but had I been an independent artist, I would have 100% put that song out.
Now, I know a little bit about Tom. Tom's pretty controversial. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know John Rich had that thing that came out with him back last year. And I guess that's part of his whole shtick.
Yeah, you know, I respect Tom. I like Tom, and I've got a deep respect for Adam Calhoun, too. And you know, they both kind of, they'll raise some hairs on some people and have some people fired up, but, you know, at the same time, is that a bad thing?
But it goes back to what I said early on, as an artist that appreciates artists, whether I have a personal like or dislike for the music or the content of what they say, I still respect the craft, and I still respect people that love the craft for whatever their platform is. I still have a lot of respect for that.
Absolutely.
And I wish more people could see that, because I think we get a lot of pushback, and I would even say a lot of hate from the other side of the aisle. And I don't feel like most of us project that back out. I mean, I'm a live and let live kind of guy, but don't get in my way. I'm not going to tell you how to live your life.
Man, you know what? I feel like most of the people that – I'm going out on a limb here, but I feel like most of the people that I know well and respect their opinion and value who they are as humans, most of us kind of ride more to the middle than we'd like to think. There's just a couple issues that send us left or right. You know, we have more in common than I think we forget how much we have in common. You know, and these people need division to have a winner and a loser.
And sometimes I think they fight just for the sake of fighting, because they're arguing about things, and half the time I don't think they understand what the side of the fence are on. They're just they're just making noise to make noise, and a lot of it is just, it's like, stop, enough's enough. I grew up in a small town, probably just like you did, man. Dry County, man, Oklahoma line was 7 minutes away, depending on how fast you drove. You know, and if you were old enough to get your money on the counter, I mean, we were drinking on a regular basis at 14, because all there was to do was drink beer and ride a gravel road. There was nothing else back there.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's the culture that I grew up in. And it's just, but people helped each other. You know, everybody went to church on Sunday morning, no matter what you did on Saturday night.
Absolutely.
You know, that was just the culture that we grew up in. And I think we've lost a lot of that Americana feel. I'd sure love to see us get back to that.
You ain't kidding. And I do think there's a lot of worth, too, to what you said about somebody who's willing to kind of speak about that and use their art to do so. Like, I'll never forget, we were playing Willie's Picnic one year, and it was when, Christopherson just started dealing with some of their stuff. And I usually don't say his name, because it was off the record, but he said something, and I'll never forget that he did an interview with the radio station there, and afterwards, I don't remember who it was, but somebody had asked him, said, "Hey man, I got a question for you off the record." He said, "What do you think about these new artists using these social media platforms to be political?" And I'll never forget, it was he said, "I can't speak negatively to it." He said, "Just I was one of those that kind of wore my politics on my sleeve." He said, "But I think there's something special about an artist who's willing to use their craft to do it. Like, if you're a singer, you know, sing a song about it. If you're a songwriter, write a song about it. And, you know, I remember thinking, like, how much power is it? How much power is there in music? You know, I think we forget that sometimes. It's like, having a voice is one thing. You know,
if there wasn't that much power in music, every politician wouldn't be trying to attach themselves to the hip of music artists.
Absolutely.
Because we have the ability to affect cultural change, to bring awareness to certain situations, to provide a lens into things that people may not be looking at. I mean, that's the power of writing and performing songs, and it's absolutely a powerful thing.
Yeah, you ain't kidding, buddy. But yeah, I do think, you know, and you said cultural. I feel like a lot of the differences we have are cultural. There was a, I won't say what publication it was, but they put my back on the wall a little bit. So there was a magazine or they were working on a article called Country Music and Guns. And I remember sitting down with a guy, and they basically said, hey, we've got pictures of your tattoo. I've got the Second Amendment tattooed across the hole of my back. And, you know, we're going to, you know, it's pretty much a free narrative at this point. He can do the interview, or we're going to post a picture and control the narrative ourselves. And I remember taking the interview, and first thing I asked the guy, you know, was like, hey, man, can we both just agree before we start this conversation that this is more of a cultural thing than anything? Like, I said, do you like country music? And he said, no. All right, well, how do you feel about guns? He said, I've never seen one in real life. It was like,
let me show you this in writing.
Yeah, no shit. Like, and I remember telling the guy and telling my publicist at the time, like, hey, you know, just for the record, I'll skip some of the details of that conversation because it was one of those where management was on the line and they'd hit a button, you know, if they wanted me to kind of hit the brakes on what I was talking. Man, they hit that button more times. It was almost just.
So it wasn't a sit down face to face thing. You're doing.
I was over the phone.
Yeah, I got you. Okay.
And you know, I'd get into certain things, and you know, I just remember thinking, what is a guy who hates country music who's never seen a gun doing writing this article? You know, and I don't think they used any of our conversation whatsoever when it finally did come out, because I told my publicist, she was friends with the editor or one of the editors. I said, you might want to give them a heads up and just let them know, you know, by putting this article out, they're selling more guns than I could if I were to go on every social media platform I have and tell somebody to go buy one. You know, it's, but, you know, I will say this too, you know, with social media effectively turning the entire world into a small town, you know, it's a cultural thing entirely, but you know, you were talking about it's a lot different. Music business is a lot different now than when you came up. Hell, it's a lot different now than when I came up. We were still able to come up playing small bars and.
Well, and cut your teeth and develop your craft, and
absolutely.
Instead of going and sing karaoke, you know, two or three times a week, and then all of a sudden you got a deal and you got to figure out how to put a show together. We learned how to do the craft.
Absolutely. And it's like, you know, watching, you know, social media do what it does. I think, you know, for me, people laugh and joke at me, but I have a stint during the show where I tell people I don't have the passwords to any of my social media accounts, and I know they all think I'm kidding, but I really don't. Like, I'm a liability. I can't. They don't trust me with them. And my manager's sitting right there. He'll tell you they don't give me them some bitches.
I don't have them either.
Yeah.
My manager's sitting right there. They don't give them to me either. Yeah, I tried Twitter a few years ago for just a little while, and I can't tell you how many fights I got into with people. I stayed pissed off all the time. It's like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
This is a marketing tool, and I'm not doing this.
Outside of being used for business, I've struggled to see the benefits of it, you know, in a family life or even in your personal life. It's like, you know, I mean, these people control the narrative and the algorithm, and it's kind of.
I like being a little anonymous.
Yeah, no joke. But it's like, you know, there is no face-to-face. You know, you kind of just, you know, go unchecked. There's no accountability. You know, people say things, get away with saying things they wouldn't say in person.
I wouldn't say to your face.
No,
they'll hide in mom and daddy's basement and be a keyboard warrior and act like they're the toughest guy on the block.
Exactly. And there's a fundamental problem with that to me. And there's no accountability.
Well, you know, I grew up in a little town. There was a town of 1,100 people. I graduated in the largest class that ever came out of the school. We had 49 graduating seniors. There were 52 of us, so obviously three didn't make it. I think they'd probably been there two or three times already. the opening day of deer season, we got the first day of deer season off. We carried guns in our vehicles. I had a Absolutely. Gun in my vehicle. I carried a pocket knife in my pocket to school all the time. It was no big thing. Yeah. You know, that was just part of the culture. Everybody talked about it. I mean, there was no big thing. I didn't grow up in a town. You know, Daddy didn't have the guns locked up in the house, but I knew if I touched his guns, he'd whoop my butt because they were loaded in the house that I grew up in. There were certain guns that I was allowed to have access to if I wanted to go squirrel hunting or I wanted to go deer hunting. The rest of it was off limits unless I was with him and he allowed me to do it till he taught me how to shoot them. But you had to grow up with an appreciation and learn some lessons and be a part of that culture. I mean, I grew up around it. I don't understand how people can pass judgment on something they don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a society, this country is based on the Second Amendment. You take that away, this country's going to fall apart. That's my personal opinion.
I mean, if you know, I saw a thing the other day, this guy was talking about, what are the two major things that we have that other countries don't? You know, if you were to take away the minuscule things, what are the two big things that we have that divide our freedom from, you know, the rest of the free world? And it is the first and second, and the second protects the first.
Well, most of the people, the criminals that have guns in this country were provided by the CIA, so you take law-abiding citizens away.
Here we go. Now we're getting into fucking weeds. Come on. Let's go.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's documented. We know. I mean, it's just part of it.
And you know what, man? On that end, I feel like they're always going to have them, you know. Those of us.
And they have their agenda and their purpose for doing what they do and why they do it. I mean, I don't understand all of it and really don't care to.
That's a fair point. And, you know, I look at it, a lot of the things that are talked about on social media, and you see how just invested these people are. And it's like, you know, you wonder why a lot of the things around you are going to shit. If you were to put half the time into your home or into your church or into your community, that you put into social media and trolling motherfuckers on there, man, it'd be an entirely different world. It'd be an entirely different life. I don't think we'd all be loaded guns walking around.
You know, Chris Young is a good friend of mine, and I'm sure you've seen the video of stuff that happened a few months back about him getting, you know, kind of attacked by the cop downtown and all that stuff.
I didn't ever get the story behind that.
It was pretty unjustified. You know, it's there's kind of things that are out of control. And I have a lot of respect for law enforcement. There's good guys out there. I know a lot of them. I'm friends with a lot of them that are good, honest, decent people that believe in right and wrong, that are trying to do good things in the community. And then there's guys that are on power trips.
Yeah,
and
sure.
It can be a little scary. I've known some of those guys, too. I've been friends with some of them. I've seen them do some things that were very questionable to me. Yeah. You know, it's a scary time that we live in, and cultural things, and you know, I just don't know, man. I don't know how we get back. My point being is as I see things like that, I kind of want to go back to Mayberry and think about Andy Griffith, man. What happened to the guy that could come in and defuse a situation that didn't need to have a gun, that didn't need to assault somebody or go on a power trip? Can't we get back to having conversations?
Well, that's the whole thing right there. You just said a lot of it. We can't communicate.
No, we're not.
We're pre-programmed to be defensive and fight. Anytime there's a, you know, a challenging topic of conversation, we're already guarded. We're loaded because you're either right or you're left.
Yeah.
You know, there's more middle ground than we remember. I truly do feel like that. Like, you know, if you were to take away a couple really divisive factors, like personally, there's some things about the left that I don't mind. Like, I really like pot. If the Republicans give me my pot and the Democrats give me my guns, I'm not real sure I'd really give a fuck.
Well, Hootie, go. Let's call Hootie. He's got it.
I'll probably have to edit that out. I mean,
hell no, that's pretty well funny. Said.
So think about this. So I'm not going to go down the race rabbit hole, but I am going to make this point because I I respect anybody that works hard and wants to take care of their family. I don't particularly see race or religion or any of that crap. None of that's relevant to me. Sexual orientation, I don't care about any of that. I respect Denzel Washington, man. What a brilliant actor. I think he's a decent man. And I was watching an interview that he was doing. It's been a while back. But he said the difference, it's a cultural thing. He was talking about a specific director that directed a movie that he was in and how this other director of the movie company was trying to force this other director, and he said it's a cultural thing. He said when it comes to black people, it's not about race. It's not about that. He said, but when I stick a comb in the back of my pocket, he said, there's something I can smell, the smell of the oil in my hair and the way it feels. He said, there's cultural things that we identify with that if you don't live the life, you can't understand it. It's not race. It's not religion. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
And people have got to start realizing that. All the stuff the media keeps feeding us, creating all this animosity and all this controversy, that's not what this is about. We need to wake up and realize what's going on around us. They're fueling all this stuff. The sooner we can wake up and back out and realize, I'm not going to play into your crap anymore, I think we can diffuse a lot of this stuff. I really believe we could if we will all get our head out of our ass.
That's the thing, though. You know, it's like the united we stand, divided we fall. It's like we forget so easy. And I say we because, you know, I feel a certain way about certain topics, and when they come up, I don't think twice about sharing my opinion on them.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like all of us are geared that way to a certain extent, but I got a song coming out on the album we're working on right now. It's called Me and My House. And you know, my approach to a lot of things changed when I had kids. And to be completely honest, I started caring about things that I really hadn't paid much attention to in the past.
Yeah.
You know, just to be brutally honest. You know, and the song basically talks about, you know, I heard they took you out of schools and you ain't in the pledge no more. You know, you're against the rules, and I know you've heard that before. Next to be the courtroom, quarters and dollar bills. It's like talking about, you know, that we're taking God out of the picture, man. I do feel like there was a certain aspect of this country that, you know, I feel like we're losing a little bit that's under attack. It's like, man... You want to get us back to Mayberry, you want to get us back to the good days, man, give it back to God. Because every little bit of it you take away from him. And, I know that's weird coming from me because I cuss like a sailor. But you know how it is. I've been on the road for 20 years. It's like...
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing. We're talking about culture today. We're some cultural motherfuckers in here. Do not get it twisted.
I got to share this with you too. We'd gone to CRS. It was last year, and so Jelly Roll was on the radio seminar on the New Faces show, and so my mom's with me, and my manager's with me, and everything. My wife's down there with me, and Jelly Roll gets up there, and I mean he's getting on his soapbox and preaching a little bit, and then he's throwing some MS out there and doing all this other stuff. As my mama's like, her eyes get about this bigger, and my mama's 80, and she reads her Bible every day. And then he comes off the stage and comes over and hugs my neck, and we have a little moment and everything. My mama's just like, what in the hell is going on? It's a cultural thing.
Well, you're running with Tracy.
But golly, I mean, look at the journey. I mean, never, you got to understand what somebody goes through in life. He's been through a journey. He's been through his own hell, man. And you got to respect the fight that he's fought to get where he's at. And for each and every one of us in our own path, because every journey through this thing is different. Every path is different.
Absolutely. I will say this, though. That one's on another level.
Yes, sir.
I got a lot of respect for that dude for a lot of reasons. One, he's the same dude every time you meet him. You know what I'm saying? He's unapologetic about being who he is.
Yep.
And I have a deep appreciation for that, especially in this world, because we got some chameleons, man.
Oh, yeah.
That can fit in any, not only any environment, but any conversation, can tell you exactly what you want to hear, turn the corner and say some other shit. You don't have to worry about that with that guy.
No, he's solid.
It's the same thing every time. The things that he's been through, you know, obviously we all have the worst experience. We all have a rock bottom, right? We all have the worst experience in our life, and I feel like everything's relative. But his rock bottom is one that not many people make it out of just to, you know, integrate back into society, let alone to break, you know, as an artist, let alone to break as an artist at 38 years old. When was the last time you heard of somebody break? And this is not, I love the man to death. I love him with my whole heart. So, brother, if you hear this, I'm not talking shit about you, but you know, back in the day, it was about having a half decent voice and a pretty face. Mm-hmm. You know, this dude's got tattoos all over. If you'd have told me that guy, he'd have showed up to Nashville 10 years ago. You know, he had to break through some serious barriers. And I do think, you know, you have your Colts and, you know, those of us that were outside of the box, man, I like to think we knocked on that door a little bit and got told no, you know, before somebody was able to really kick it in the way he has. But I really am. I'm proud to know the guy. And you know, his story is one that, you know, inspired and motivated me. I remember kind of being the bad guy on the scene at one point. You know, I was a bad boy. I never went to prison. I went to jail. But being able to tell a prison story, I don't have any of those. I've never been.
No.
But, you know, I do think I've – and the more and more I got to know him, the more I've learned to respect him and also realize how truly smart the guy is.
Hell, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of crazy. And he kind of came in and fucked the game up because he's treating the music business like the street and they don't know how to handle it. And I love that shit. It's like, you know, you see him in a conversation, he's just shaking people down. And by the time he's swept you off your feet, you don't know what happened.
He completely disarms you.
Absolutely.
He just does. It's amazing to watch him work. He's just really good at it.
And the thing, you know, when he testified, you know, when he spoke the other day, you know, was it Congress?
Yeah. Yeah, I think him and Laney both were there.
Oh my gosh, man! It was just, you know, when he takes the mic and the cameras are on, it's not well. I take that back wholeheartedly. Not just when the cameras are on. When he gets into a conversation he's passionate about, he kind of turns into a pastor.
Oh, I've seen it.
You know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely, he gets on that box
get to preaching.
Man.
Yeah, oh,
without a doubt. Yes, and he will.
You know what? I'm here for it. You know, a lot of the things he has to say, you know, I mean, obviously they're opposing points of view, but he definitely...
It'll make you think.
Yeah, it you know, it calls everything into question, and he damn sure can push the envelope on his side of whatever that argument is. You know, and with him, something I've noticed too is, you know, he's taking issue with things that are not so debatable. This is... You know, when you talk about the opioid crisis or the fentanyl crisis, like, you know, what he said is coming from a place that he's extremely familiar about. He disarms them completely by saying, I'm not a Democrat or Republican. In fact, my right to vote has been stripped from me because of my past. Like, that disarms. You just took a gun out of the holster, every single person in that room.
Yeah, he ain't touring Canada.
Bless his heart. You know, I hope he eventually works something out where he can, because, I think that dude's message and that dude's story should be one, you know, that should be able to be shared internationally.
Absolutely. And you got to respect it. So let's shift gears and let's kind of talk more about music. I want to talk about songwriting. I want to talk about show structure. I want to kind of talk about how you have evolved into this place and what your mental process is about putting a new tour together. Start off with songs, man. What's your songwriting approach, man? When you're writing, do you write all the time? I mean, I'm not an all-the-time writer. I got to kind of block other things out. Do you keep ideas back? There's certain people you collaborate with. What's your song approach?
Most of the time, I mean, you know how it is. If a writer comes out on the road, it, you know, there may be an idea. I mean, a fly on the wall could inspire you to write one. You know, so I never rule those out. But in general, man, I'm not one of those guys that tries to write every day. You know, I found that I did for a minute, and I started catching myself kind of putting, you know, really solid lines in the songs that weren't necessarily going to be used. You know, you burn a good line, you know, and I noticed that, you know, I realized if I keep some of those lines back and just keep them in a notepad, I'm putting together a song full of those lines.
Yeah.
As opposed to having a couple good lines in a subpar song, let's save them. And, you know, when it's time to put together a record, you know, we got an arsenal in the notepad of my phone. I still handwrite a lot of things. But my process, like all of ours, has changed through the years. You know, my first record, I wrote every one of them by myself.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to co-write, you know. And I came to town and learned that. And, you know, I think all of us kind of find that group that we know we're productive with. I try to branch out every now and then just to, you know, get a different experience and kind of tap into a well I hadn't tapped into yet. And, you know, I learn something every time I write with somebody new. But I do have a core group of guys that I feel like we're extremely productive. They know me. They know my music.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those guys, even when we're not doing retreats or this, that, and other to do an album, you know, if they start a song, the guys that I write with on a regular basis, they know I don't want to replace a word. I'm not going to replace one word and put my name on something.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, I like to really be able to put my fingerprint on it. So if they get on something they feel like could be something I would cut, they'll call me and be like, hey, you know, we got this so far. Are you interested in it? And I'm like, yeah, don't fuck with it anymore. You know, leave me room to do my thing and, you know, at least earn my name on the song. So in the off season, so to speak, that's kind of how we get by. We kind of sit some songs aside. And then when we get ready to do a record, you know, I'll have a list. I think this last one, we started with 80 something and whittled down to 50, and then top 50, top 30, top 20. And with the deal I have with my label right now, we're, you know, we had to whittle down to 10, 11.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of, for me, you know, the label's looking more for what could work at radio, you know, what would stream well, what wouldn't. And this is a fault of mine as a businessman, but telling my story and my albums being chapters of my life and having themes and actually saying something is important to me, you know, as opposed to having a, you know, a list of 10 or 11 songs that are really, really catchy and clever and all that. I'd rather have several on there. You know, when we did this deal, we kind of divided it in half. It's like, you figure out what's commercial, we'll cut those five. Let me tell my story with the other five. And we cut those five yesterday. And, man, I got to tell you, there's just something to me. When I miss the days when, I mean, I'm sure you remember this, but going to stand in line, when you knew there was an artist and you were one of them.
Absolutely.
When you had an album coming out, you had to go to Walmart down the road. I didn't have to go to Best Buy to get yours. You know, if it was parental advisory on it, we had to go to record shop or Best Buy. I could get yours at Walmart. I remember standing in line when you put an album out. And, man, I couldn't wait to get that thing, and I'd live with it. You know, and, I mean, the deep cuts or the B-sides, you know, we're putting out records now. If you put out 10, you may be burning 8 of them.
Yeah, and I respect exactly what you're saying, because I worry that so many people aren't cutting records. I always went into a project feeling like, you know, I grew up in the area where when I bought a record, I wanted to hear the whole thing. I wanted to listen to it from top to bottom, because it wasn't just about one song or going into the next one. It was about the flow. Why did they put that song there? What musicians played on it? I want to see the credits. What studio did they cut in? Who produced it? Who wrote it, even if the artist didn't write it? I wanted to have all the information. I wanted to understand, you know, was this a filler song? Did the label make them? I mean, I was trying to figure all that stuff out.
Yeah.
And I think nowadays, I see a lot of things that are just cut a song at a time. This one's, you know, we're just going to, it's just the process has changed. I don't think people are cutting packages. I miss the days of buying albums, too, when there was, the artwork was part of the whole process.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, all that's gone. And my kids, man, and how old are your kids right now?
4 and 6.
So they haven't got to this point yet. Mine are 20 and 22. But my kids grew up in a generation where they got access to all this stuff in the palm of their hand. And none of it means anything to them. They don't have to anticipate or wait for anything. And even if they do have an artist that they like, if it's 2 or 3 years between project, they're so overwhelmed by all the content they have, they really kind of forget about it. Nothing means anything. It's really a hard thing to get through that. And I hate that about this time and place we live in.
It's, man, there are advantages to it, right? A lot of the rules have gone away.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going in and cutting albums. There was a time, I remember two albums in particular, going in and having just some straight rock songs and just some stuff that was really out of the box, that you know, the only thing country about it were the lyrics, and trying to take those songs and mold them towards what the rest of the album sounded like. You know, we don't have to do that anymore, but I miss being able to tell that story. You know, I've been asked a couple times, people ask me if I'm ever going to write a book, you know, whether it's about sobriety or just my journey or whatever. It's like, man, I did. If you listen to my albums, those are chapters of my life. You'll know a hell of a lot about me and what I think about this, that, and other if you listen to my albums. But, two, you said something, man, the B sides or the deep cuts, those were always my. I feel like my favorite songs on an album were always the ones, you know, that you had to get deep into a record to get to. What was the, you had, so the album that had Texas Tornado on it, you had two singles off of that, right?
Texas Tornado, that was the I See It Now. I had four singles.
I See It Now.
Four singles off that. That had I See It Now. It had If the World Had a Front Porch. It had Any Fool Can See. And Texas Tornado were the singles off of it.
Four singles off one.
And they were all four number ones.
Man, I See It Now. There was one, there was a ballad on that record, though, that I don't think got singled. And I can't remember which one it was.
Ballad on that record.
Maybe a mid. But I wore that CD out. I mean, straight wore it out. And I was always a fan of your voice, but that album, when you put that one out, for whatever reason, that was always my favorite. That I See It Now song, too.
That's my favorite song of all the stuff that I've done, man. Just the melody and everything about that song. You know, Dan Huff played on that record. That's Dan Huff's solo on that record.
Can we talk about that, man, for a minute?
Is he not a genius?
He's a genius, but, dude, you know what? That is one of the most genuine humans I've ever met. He's just a good soul, man. He, you know, the last few records we've gone a different route. I kind of wanted to try my hand at co-producing and stuff.
Yep.
You know, but we did several records with Dan, and man, you know, to this day, he every Christmas, every birthday, just randomly in the middle of the week, sometimes he'll write me, you know, a long text, or it'll be an audio recording. You know, the audio notes you can do now, which I'm a fan of. It's like a, you know, a sendable version of the Nextel chirp, you know. But he sent me one of those a few weeks ago, man, and it warmed my heart. He's just a good human. And I got to tell this story, and I've never told this before, but my manager and I were riding around one day, and we saw Dan, and we didn't have shit to do for a minute. So we were like, I wonder what Dan Huff does on his day off. And if I'm lying, I'm dying. That Joker went to feed the hungry by himself. Nobody in the car with him. He just pulled up. And I was like, that's a different cut of human being. That's just a different human. And in this business, I mean, there are good people in it, right? But very seldom do you come across one like that. That's just heart and soul solid. I love that guy, man.
And still has such a deep-seated passion for the music. And when he goes into a project, you can tell that he puts his heart and soul into it. I mean, it's not just going in, cutting some sides and just getting through the project. I mean, he's committed to it. I mean,
that's old school. You know.
Absolutely. And sometimes he probably pushed you a little harder when he could have probably tuned that line, but he wanted the performance.
So he worked with me before I quit drinking. And he tells this story. He tells it a lot better than I do, but it was the first time I worked with him. And I had heard who he was, but to be completely honest with you, man, when it came to the music business, not that I was necessarily sheltered, but I didn't see many shows. You know, you'll get in interviews and people ask you, what was the favorite show you ever saw? Well, I don't know. From the time I was old enough to go to shows, I was playing them. You know, every time a bar door was open, if they give me a stage, I was going to try to make enough to make it to the next town, you know, gas money-wise. But he said, so I had heard of Dan Huff, and I knew, you know, his discography and you know, the genius work that he had done in the past. But I was kind of raw in this town, man. Nobody really knew how to take me. And this is when I was still drinking. So I was abrasive as fuck, even when I didn't mean to be. And I was in the booth, and apparently, he remembers it a lot better than I do for multiple reasons. You know, I didn't just like drinking. There were other things that went with it that, you know, the old memory ain't so great anyway. But he said that I walked in the booth and sang something, and he goes, man, that was really good. That was really good. All right, sing it again. And he said, I looked through the thing and took my cans off and set them down and I said, why? And he said, it was one of the first times in his career that he was like, I need to be careful with the way I said, you know, like I come back with it. Wow. Yeah, why? You told me I did a great job. Why I need to do it again? You would do a great job twice? You know, so I was totally raw, man, in the studio. So I literally cut my teeth, you know, on major production with Dan Huff. And you know, it's kind of like starting at the finish line and tapping out
of
the way.
It's like killing a 22-point non-typical when you're 14 years old. Absolutely. What do you do after that?
Absolutely, man. Yeah, that and, man, just to see, you talk about his passion for the music and the record. You know, you see so many guys, and I'm one of them. I feel like I'm entering the crotchety old man phase of life early. You know what I'm saying? Like, I am one step away from screaming at people for driving fast.
I already did, man.
You know what I mean? Like, turn that music down. You know, fuck, I'm a year away from that. I don't know if it's when you have kids, like, with every year they get older, you get a little more crusty. I don't know what the deal is, but, yeah, you know, there's so many guys, I'll be the first to tell you, I'm not going to bullshit you. There are things that go on. You know, we're talking about a new way of doing things in this business and, you know, the current climate of society. And I am a crotchety old man to a certain extent. And, man, it's easy to get bitter, you know, in this business and in any other. You know, I've never been one necessarily to, you know, not want good things to happen for people, but damn sure you look at some things that are going on, you're like, damn, that door wasn't open for me.
I've got this plane, and the plane's going down, and I put people on the son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I got a handful of people right now that I can name that I want. They're on the plane.
Yeah.
There's an ex-wife on there. There are a couple of people that I toured with that are on there. There's some people back home that are on there.
Yeah.
There's a contractor or two on there.
There's a special seat for them.
There's a special seat for them sons of bitches right there. Well, contractors, some of the sorriest people on the planet. Sorry.
I'm telling you, though. You know what? To see a guy like Dan and this new way of producing that's coming up where you can do shit. You can produce an entire song on a laptop.
Oh, yeah.
These samples sound legitimately real now.
Yeah.
And to have a guy like Dan, Dan's way of doing things at this point is damn near old school.
And you know, and I know a lot of people, and we all do it periodically, and I still hate it. There's something about getting a full section of musicians in a band, because even if you're producing, and you think, I mean, I'll go in when I'm co-producing and doing stuff, and I'll get it all mapped out in my head, and when those guys get in that room, and they start communicating, and things happen, it gets a life of its own. So you're hiring people because of what they bring to the table.
Absolutely.
And if you just lay a drum track down and an acoustic guitar with a vocal on it and you send it to this one and you send it to this one, you've taken the ability of that song's evolution out of play.
Absolutely.
And I hate seeing that happen.
Yeah, I mean, when COVID happened, we were in the middle of an album. We didn't have any choice but to do that. And
I know.
You know, there were things that turned out that I wasn't displeased with, you know, but there is something about, you know, like I said, Dan's way of doing things is almost old school, but it's to me, man, it warms my heart to see that guy work on a project because, you know, it fucking matters.
Oh, it
you know,
does.
That process and every little sound. Yeah, we can get it in an app and replicate it, but how about we go find the amp in the head and the guitar that makes that sound? You know, and how about we pair it with this snare drum here, this, that, you know.
Back in the day before everything was in a box, and if you were looking for something, I've heard of people going outside and taking hubcaps off of cars to hit them with a drumstick. Just all different manner of things, trying to find those sounds, going through a dozen guitars and just a rack of amps trying to find the worst. And now, it just because they say everything's in a box, it's just not the same.
It's not. It never will be. And
there's something about cranking an amp to 11.
Absolutely. You ain't kidding, buddy.
And getting that air and getting that mic back off of it and getting that tone. You can't get that power without cranking it up.
And there's
can't.
Also something about music and it bringing people together and coming together for a common goal, and that is to make that song, to play it the best you can. There's, you know, I think that's one of the things that COVID showed me. I think we forgot as a society how, you know, how much power there is in music and its ability to bring us together. You know, because you go out to shows, I mean, there's people from the left and right and the middle, indifferent, every shape and color and size and gender, whatever the fuck you want to be today. You know, and they're at the show and they're enjoying music together.
Yeah.
And that, man, the COVID thing happened. That was one of the first things I noticed was, man, it does something for me. It does something for me in my heart when I go to a show and I see – you know, people all different shapes and sizes, and colors and genders and everything. Just doing something together, you know, coming and, you know, you may not agree with what the dude's saying on stage. If I'm on stage, there's probably some people from the left that definitely don't fucking agree with what I'm saying. But, you know, they're there and they're doing something and enjoying something together, you know. And I think that, you know, a lot of times for me, that comes in the studio. When I get in there yesterday, man, we had some new guys on session yesterday that I never worked with. And, man, these dudes are freaking monsters. And to see them get in there together and play in a live room, you're right. There's just something that I don't know if you ever be able to put a finger on it or define what that actually is. But there's something about, you know, being in the room together.
You know, I was watching an interview of Rick Beato. Familiar with him, Rick Beato.
I know the name.
YouTube. So he's a musician from the West Coast. Anyway, he had Bukovac on, Tom okay. Bukovac. And Buk was talking about how the biggest challenge for him, he said, if you're in the studio and you've got a master session going on and you're going through the track and you're coming back and you're playing your solo and you think you just freaking nailed it and you just freaking killed it. The producer says, let's try a different direction. Let's do X, Y, Z. And all of a sudden, you got to back up. You got to change your whole mindset. You got to get your ego and your attitude out of the way. And you got to play the next pass completely different with the same passion, the same intensity that you had with the first time. And might have to do it 3 or 4 more times.
Absolutely.
That's the gift of a true, really talented session player. So much of that shit is mental, man.
Absolutely. And man, you know, session players are a different breed.
Oh, without a doubt.
You know, man, my guys, you know, I've got a drummer. He's my longest standing band member. He's been with me going on 20 years now. And man, this dude, like, you could take him in the studio and he'd do fine. And there for a minute, I remember some of my band guys kind of being bent out of shape. We weren't going to the studio. And it was like, man, you guys don't understand. It's just different. These guys get in there and turn on a dime. But it's also in the way they communicate. You know, and eventually, absolutely. And I do want to do a record, either if not the one after this, the next. I do want to cut like a, you know, I had a record called Halfway to Heaven where we cut it in Athens and we cut it with our guys and it took forever. But it's probably one of my favorite records I ever put out, my first two.
Let's talk about that a little bit because I've pondered on that. I'm friends with some rock and roll guys. I mean, I know the guys from Three Doors Down. Brad's been a dear friend of mine for a long time, and I remember several years ago they'd rented Oceanway for like 3 months. You know, yeah. Oceanway's not a cheap studio.
Somebody forked out some cash.
So probably. They came in, they sat down. Not only did they rent the studio for 3 months, they rented a house. None of them lived here at the time, so they rented a house out in Brentwood that they all stayed together. So they were coming to the studio, they were writing in the studio, they were doing all this stuff, and I've talked to him about it. How different is that? I mean, because I've heard of, you know, guys like Motley Crue having to bring like a guitar player in to help you navigate through, leading you through the guitar passes and helping Nikki Sixx learn how to play the fucking bass.
Yeah.
So, you know, all that stuff. So how
can you imagine having that job?
Okay.
That would suck.
But I'm just saying, going through the process, it takes so much longer. And I've heard of them playing tracks 30, 40 times.
Absolutely.
And continuing to evolve it to work out a dynamic or keep searching for a guitar tone. And in that world, you all go down together.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the way it is. And the process that we have where we all go in and we write in advance and we get all these things mapped out. A lot of times you go in the demo room, you demo something on a cheap scale just to kind of get the pieces mapped out. By the time you go in with the A-team, you can cut 6 songs in 2 sessions if you're real efficient and then absolutely. Come in and do vocals for 2 days and you're done.
Yeah, we did 5 yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, 5-6 songs is not unreasonable in a 10 and a 2, baby.
Yeah, that wasn't happening back then. On that record, it was, man, you know what? But I feel like you can hear it. And there are little imperfections in there. There are things we didn't iron out. And I think they're as cool as the things we did. Is, you know, there's something about them old records, man. When you hear string slides and stuff, and all those imperfections that we pull out now, there's just an authenticity there that's
when you hear the breath of a vocal.
Exactly.
When just the air on the bow of an instrument. I use fiddle a lot still, but there's something about that. A fiddle is kind of like you got to treat it like a vocal. It's got to breathe, and if you squish it down too much, everything's just so
Yeah, it's a computer program.
So when you approach putting your show together, say you're working on a new album, and I'm sure you think about this to some degree. You know, you write a whole bunch of stuff, and as it all starts to wrestle down to that 10, 11 songs, it's like, I got a spot in the show for this one. I don't have this groove. I don't have this tempo. As you start to wrestle that stuff down, do you write leading to that place? Are you looking to fill certain gaps or make evolutionary changes in the show? I mean, do you think about that stuff when you're going in the studio too?
I do. We try to approach it where, you know, if there's a vibe we need for the show, say there's a song that, I mean, and you know this as good as anybody, there's a difference, you know, even if a song goes number one, it doesn't necessarily mean it's an impact record.
Amen, brother.
Impactful enough to keep playing for 10 years and people still give a shit.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So it's like, we had that conversation yesterday. It was like, you know, I had a couple, for the first time I have a band that this is the second show they've come in where it's, you know, the band leaders, I've got two band leaders. They came to me and said, hey, man, will you give us a shot at putting a set list together? And my first response was in my head was like,
hell no.
Are you off your fucking rocker? Like, I've been doing this. No, you know. But honestly, I lived with it and thought about it. And I was like, you know what? Give it a shot. I got to try new stuff. I'm old and crusty. Like, you know, I'm just ornery. I need to try new stuff. Yeah, give it a shot. And honestly, you know, they did some things. I remember going in, having my gun loaded, you know, just thinking I was about to shoot everything down and hearing some things and being like, okay, that works. And I never would have thought to do that. So I've been more open-minded on that end. But, you know, as far as when it comes to a record, this one in particular, we have a song called Off the Rails. It'll be the first release off the album. And there's no intentions of it going to radio.
Yeah.
There's no intentions of doing anything outside of it being the tour's the Off the Rails tour and the song's called Off the Rails. And it's a banger, man. It's a show opener. We needed a show opener. We've been opening a show went through two tours now where we've been opening with Kicking in the Sticks because we kind of let the show tell a story. And it was almost chronological. You know, you could hear, you know, we start the show with a lot of stuff from the beginning. And we trickle some newer stuff in, just, you know, but in large part, it was like, you know, there were several years where, you know, the set kind of would go through almost in order chronologically of kind of the evolution of our music and kind of tell a story in itself. But, you know, we're kind of getting away from that, letting a little more ebb and flow and you know, I'm in a different chapter in my career, man. And you know, I'm in a spot where... And I'm sure you can relate to this. I'm in a spot where I have songs that 4 or 5 years ago, I could have played twice in the set list and they'd have been right on board with it. That now you're lucky to get a verse chorus in without losing some folks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we've kind of adjusted our, you know, we've taken a new approach the last 2 years. When we went out, we did a Nickelback tour last year. It was a 60-minute set, and we were trying to whittle down songs, and I was like, man, I don't want to lose that song out of the set. And we kind of got to the point where it's a totally new approach for us, but, man, it's worked really well. It worked insanely well on that tour. Instead of taking the song out of the set list, what if you verse chorus it? You know, what if you go in, hit a verse chorus, solo, hit that chorus again, and, you know, transition into another one? So, you know, our goal – for this will be the first time we've tried it as a headliner this year. You know, where it's 90 minutes wide ass open like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kind of gives you an opportunity. You know, you're not playing 3.5, 4.5 minute songs. You're verse chorusing and out, but it gives us an opportunity to kind of work some covers in to re-engage people that we may have lost here, there. And you kind of sneak some new stuff in and get away with it.
You know, and that's a pretty notable thing to pay attention to. We live in a culture now where the attention span is definitely a lot shorter. Very, very short. I mean, if you're watching TikTok, yeah, I particularly like to do things on YouTube where I'm watching an hour. Joe Rogan can be a little long-winded with a 3-hour podcast and stuff, but
yeah,
about an hour, hour and a half, you know, I like to listen to that stuff. But some of that, I really had to stop watching TikTok. I had to, because it just shortens that shit up.
I go 1 month on and 2 months off with those platforms, and they don't give me my password to Instagram. Anytime when my buddy sends me like a link to Instagram thing, I'm like, I can't fucking watch it, dude. You know what I mean? Because I know me well enough to know I don't spend much time in comment sections. Because when I do, I read them, and it's not like it deep seat bothers me. Because at the end of the day, unless you're willing to say it right here, there ain't much value to it. You know, but if somebody gets on there and says something about somebody I care about, they can talk shit about me all day long. But I get on there and somebody says something about somebody I care about, I start wondering who, you know, Cod Chaser 556 is. You know what I'm saying?
Start figuring out how close they live to me.
Yeah, I start thinking about calling my Navy SEAL buddy. Be like, y'all track this motherfucker down? I just want to see if he'll say it to me.
Rogan says you got to post and ghost. You just throw something up there and then just don't go back. Don't read.
Don't go back and look at
it. Get
out of it, dude. I just got off the country music cruise and spent a week on there. And my mom with me. And she's 80, so it was great spending time with her. And she met this woman. I had done my show on Tuesday night, and I had my sleeves rolled up. Of course, I love my ink, man. It's body art. I'm kind of passionate about all this stuff. And she came up to me and she said, "I really wish you'd when you do your show, would you roll your sleeves down so we don't have to look at that?" I said, "My skin." Yeah, I'm telling you, she really did. I had another woman came up to my wife and looked right at her and said, "You look really high maintenance." Oh my God. I'm not.
What the hell's going on in this cruise ship, bro? It's brutal honesty.
I just laughed, but I was real calm. My wife laughed at me when the woman walked out. I said, "You know what?
It's that is social media in the wild.
It's it's feral."
Holy shit.
So let's talk about the ink, man. So Bubba Irwin is working on this arm. You know Bubba?
No, I know the name.
Aldine hooked me up with Bubba, man. So this was something that I've wanted to do for a long time. And I know we were talking about a little ink before. And this is one of my favorites. Travis Harper from Idaho, my guitar player, hooked me up with Travis. This is my country music Mount Rushmore. And I thought long and hard about this. So it's got George Strait, Merle Haggard, Keith Whitley. I mean, George Strait, George Jones, Keith Whitley, and Merle Haggard. So tell me your music Mount Rushmore.
Man, music Mount Rushmore is tough for me.
It's not just country. I mean, it's your thing.
Yeah, I'd have to put Skinner up there.
Okay.
It was something about listening to a Skinner record, man, when I was a kid. My parents had that. Granted, I had a wreck after high school that hit my head pretty hard. I don't remember a lot of my childhood. But I do remember for whatever reason that my parents had, it was like a box of tapes, like cassette tapes. And I had a little Walkman, and I finally, you know, technology moved ahead a little bit, and they put that Walkman out that you could hit it and it wouldn't stop the tape.
Yeah.
Make it skip. And buddy, dude, I could tote that thing on my bicycle. And I remember just riding around listening to a little bit of everything. And, I'll never forget finding a Skinner record. And be like, man, now we're talking. Like, them, oh, that's something different. And, you know, they were talking about things that I understood in a completely different chapter of life. Like, as a young kid, you know, hearing that stuff was like, I could still relate to it. And it was, you know, I'll never forget that feeling. It just, you listen to a Skinner record, man, it feels like home. You know,
there was something comforting about it for sure, man. And, you know, like, not just Sweet Home Alabama, but a lot of the B-sides, like Curtis Lowe, a lot of those old cultural things, man. That was just, I mean, it was just honest and it was raw. Ronnie was a badass.
Yeah.
Ronnie Van Zant was a badass, man.
Man, I got to say, Gary was one of my favorite humans. We got a chance to do CMT Crossroads with him.
Yeah. And Johnny's a badass, too. I love Johnny. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time with him over the years, man.
He's a good dude. I like Johnny.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Ronnie was intense, man.
Oh, you serious about his shit? Oh, yeah. I remember having a conversation with Gary about that. It was like, you know, man, when Gary passed away, that was kind of a gut check moment. What impressed me about them as much as anything, especially him, was when we did that thing, I take a lot of pride in what it took us 20 years to build. I had, dude, just some amazing people God blessed with me, blessed me with and put in my life that helped me create this thing that shouldn't have happened, right? And, you know, when we show up a lot of times, like, I can tell you Toby Keith was one of these. Tim McGraw was one of these. But I remember not knowing what to think, you know, how Johnny was going to be, or how Gary's going to be. And getting in there, and, man, they treated not just my band, but my crew the same way they did me. And that, I'll never forget that as long as I live. That meant the freaking world to me, man. You know, there's just something about it. It's just different. And you can tell, like, that's not a new thing. That's
where they are.
Yeah, that had to be from the ground up. That never changed. You know what I mean? We all have, I feel like we all have some negative touring experiences where you're like, man, yeah, I'm never doing that to somebody. You know, but.
Oh, yeah.
It's, but yeah, I'd have to say they'd have to be on it. And I had to put Bo Zivas on there just because I just love everything about him. Rhett Akins has one of the best Hank Jr. stories of all time. And I'd have to let him tell it, but. You know, the summary of it, the long short of it was, you know, if you met Hank Jr. and he wasn't an asshole, I'd be disappointed. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I meet this guy and he comes up, he's like, hey, nice to meet you, you know, really glad to have you. I think I would be disappointed. Like, if he comes up and he was like, who the fuck is this guy? What is he? You know, okay, there we go. You know what I mean? Like, just the ultimate, you know, double finger to the world. And honestly, I'm here for the stage meltdowns too. That shit's entertaining. You know, that recording they finally put out on YouTube where he goes off on everybody, Garth included. Oh,
that was the Kansas City.
I was like, holy shit. That's great, man. Yeah. This is gold. Man, shit, if I had a Mount Rushmore, I might put them two on there just twice. That'd just be my four. It'd be like, everybody else can fuck off. It's hard to touch those two. But yeah, man, we actually got a few shows with him this year. And I'm really excited about it. One of them is literally on my wedding anniversary. It popped up, and you know, this will be our 9 year. And I called my wife and I said, "Hey, so a show, an opportunity popped up on our wedding anniversary." And she was like, "Well, you know," and that's something we're pretty, you know, we're pretty old school about that. We try to be intentional about.
Yeah,
you know, birthdays, you know, anniversaries, things like that. We're pretty strict on not, you know, having my job step on that, because for so long, you know, this has never been a job for us. It's life, you know what I mean, and our lives kind of have to revolve around a career. So we make a conscious effort to, you know, not let my job step on everything. And you know, it's kind of an unspoken rule. I try not to do things on birthdays or you know, wedding anniversaries. But when that one popped up, I got called and I said, "Hey, there's something that popped up that I got to do." And she was like, "On our anniversary?" And I was like, "Yeah, but baby, it's Hank Jr." You know, and she was like, "You know what about my wife? She knows me well enough to know that she never once contested it." She was like,
"Good woman."
Okay, well, we'll work around it. You know, I didn't even have to fight for it. I was like, "Yeah, that's a good woman, man."
Damn right,
that's a good woman.
But it's Bo Cephas, baby.
Yeah, I mean, hey, well, you know, but you know, it's. I'd have to say, yeah, Skinner, Bo Cephas for sure. Cash would have to be on it. I wear all black for a reason. A couple different reasons. One, I had this manager that was a real piece of shit, and he wore all black all the time. When we split, went in our different ways, like, I wanted to take who he was. So,
you sucked the soul out of him.
I'm telling you what. People ask why I've been wearing a black hat for 20 years. I ain't shitting you at all. I'm petty like that, bro. You no longer have an identity. I know that's some rancid shit. I'm well aware. This dude did some fucked up shit. So awesome. He deserved it. But yeah, I'd have to put Cash up there. Just, man, for the obvious reasons. But also, man, I remember not just seeing that movie, but hearing stories about him and the man he was. I was always inspired by, you know, that kind of just tortured soul aspect of him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was like he went deep before it was cool to go dark and deep. you know, and you know, he's so outside the box. And dude, honestly, I think I'd have to put Elvis up there. That'd probably be my fourth.
Very cool.
Just because, you know, man, I have a deep appreciation for those who are willing to go against the grain and do shit you ain't supposed to. And, you know, I just have a soft spot in my heart for guys like that. And he was, you know, that was another one of the ultimate guys. It was just kind of like, I loved in that movie. I keep up well. Elvis pretty decent. Like, you know, we've been to Graceland and been to see the original home site, Memphis and stuff. And, you know, it was just, he did something so different than anything that was going on. It
shook the whole country, man.
Right. And
it shook it up,
man. And
it changed it.
Yes. To this day, it's different because of that guy. And, you know, you can't help but respect it. I listen back to a lot of music, and for me, it's just as much about who he was and the way he went about things as it was the music. Music was cool, but, man, like watching that movie when that cop told him, if you so much as wiggle a finger, you're going to jail. And he looked at him, and they said that was one thing. I talked to a guy that was pretty close to the situation. He was like, no, that was a real thing.
Holy shit.
He looked over at it, he was like, he looked still with his finger like that's the ultimate to me. So yeah, I get that's a crazy route, Mount Rushmore, but that would
I like
be it,
man.
Talking about tattoos, man, I'm pretty excited. We this album we're working on, the title track of the album, all of my albums from day one, be that a faith-based spiritual, you know, title.
Yeah,
this will be the first that on surface isn't. It'll be, you know, the cover will be either my cross here or my cross here, but it's gonna be called Tattoos, and there's a song that goes with it that is pretty much the theme of the record and the title track and the whole thing. There's some interest in taking it to country radio. I'm hesitant because it's a little outside the box, but it's the first time I've heard a tattoo song that doesn't suck. As a guy with tattoos, you know, a lot of times when you hear a song about tattoos, it's, you know, the vibe behind it or the message behind it is, look at my cool tattoos. If you talk to a real tattoo person, their stories, they're things that matter to us, man. And a lot of mine, I mean, I'm literally covered from, when I say head to toe, my neck's open. And my face, I hadn't gone there. And I don't really plan on going to my face. It's just something about that, there. You know. Yeah.
My mama might disown me. She has to swallow a whole lot of this. She hates it all. And I keep trying to tell her, I said, it's a personal thing. It's art to me. And they reflect a time or a place or a situation or some travel experience or something that they're special to me, and each one of them for their own reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of what the song talks about. It's like, you know, a lot of mine, I have respect on my chest. And when I got it, I got it for a different reason. You know, it was a little gangster. I ain't gonna lie to you. But, you know, but now when I see it, you know, if I get out of the shower and I catch it in the mirror, it's like, hey, man, it reminds me, like, make a conscious effort to show people respect. You know, until they give you a reason not to. You know, because I'm a little bit of a hothead and no stranger to confrontation. To be honest with you, I don't mind it much. Especially as I get older in age, I'm sitting here talking like I'm 97 years old, but I just turned 39, and I feel like I'm in my 70s, dude. I'm not kidding at all.
I just turned 37, man, so I'm right on the rise with that.
Dude, I'm getting the crotchety old man thing's a real deal. But
I think that's just a whole lot of don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I think there's the place that you get to in life where you just get kind of comfortable with yourself, and you say, you know what? I'm good with me. Whether you like me or not, I really don't give a shit.
That's a real thing.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to be wrong anymore.
No, and that's part of the journey, man. If I'm wrong and I know it, I don't have a problem admitting that I'm wrong. I don't have a problem saying I'm sorry.
That's the last 5 years for me that has been a real change. And I don't know if that come, you know, I got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. Maybe that came with being a dad. Yeah. You know what I mean? But it's like, you know, I will say, my wife kind of gets the worst of it sometimes. I really don't like losing arguments with my wife. I just, you know, but, you know, the last 5 or 6 years, I haven't minded it as much. And you know, I said that in joking mostly, but there's some value to it too. My wife's extremely smart, and she's right about shit a lot. And you know, marriage is marriage, man. We're gonna argue. We're gonna see things differently from time to time. And I just want to be right every now and then. With her. It still matters at home. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's, you know, the kids are in there. I got to be right in front of somebody. But I actually am in a chapter in my life where I'm okay being wrong. You know, I'm cool with learning stuff.
The older I get, the less I realize I know. I used to think I knew everything. When I was young, I thought I knew everything.
In my 20s, drinking and filled up and everything else, I thought I had to answer, buddy.
I tell my kids all the time, I said, y'all think y'all know everything. When I was your age, I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. What? Well, nothing I didn't know. But yeah, isn't it, that, man, this crazy, beautiful, fucked up, dark, awesome, terrible thing called life is just, man... That little 4-year-old and that little 6-year-old have a way of reminding me how complicated and how simple it is all at the same time.
Just all that innocence, man. And one of the things with all the crap going on in the world, my goal as a parent was to try to protect that innocence as long as I could.
Yeah.
And I think and with all the just the sexual violence and the pedophilia and the crap that's just everywhere you turn, when did we fall? When did we go there? Because the innocence of a child to me is the most precious thing you have, because the longer they can hold on to it and the longer you can protect them, the better off their life's going to be.
Absolutely. And I do believe in exposure. And I'm aware with, you know, with my kids, I'm going to have some conversations with my kids before certain conversations with my kids before most parents, because the minute they're old enough to read or understand a story, they're gonna be like, Dad, what's rehab? And why'd you go?
and if yours are like mine, they're gonna look up everything about you.
Yeah,
they're gonna know, they're gonna find things that you would just assume would be buried, but the internet's there and it's forever.
Yeah,
they're gonna find it all.
And you know what? I've kind of made peace with it. And my son, the other day, we got pulled over, and you know, so the jail conversation came up at dinner. For whatever reason, I can't remember. Something about being pulled over, but somehow it transitioned into jail. And he was like, you know, and I was telling him, like, jail's not somewhere you want to go, buddy. Like, it's not fun. Right? So he was like, Daddy, have you been to jail? And it kind of took my wife by surprise. But, man, I've kind of got some of these conversations preconceived. He's like, I didn't miss a beat. He's like, Daddy, have you ever been to jail? Yeah, buddy. I have, more than once. You know, and the reason why is a story for later in your life, but just know it's not somewhere you want to go. And I'm going to do my best to raise you in a way that kind of leads you away from it. But you know what? I heard something the other day that somebody said that, you know, we take too much credit for, you know, the way our children are going to turn out. Like, they're born with their personality, and they, you know, God has a predetermined, you know, plan for them.
Yep.
You know, obviously the freedom of choice is still there. And the freedom to make decisions, you know, whether or not they're, you know, God's intentions for you or their own thing. But I do think it's our job to give them that foundation, right? And at least, you know, when they take their first couple steps, like, but at least be pointing them not off a cliff.
Or at least like the bowling lanes, that when you put the bumpers up on the side of the bowling alleys, when they just be there to kind of lightly nudge them back into
like
the lane.
I like that.
That's the way I always looked at it. Just be the bumpers, man. Don't force them here. Just kind of bump them back in line.
It is wild to me, though. But, you know, with my wife, I can honestly say the first time they heard and repeated cuss words was not my fault, which was actually very surprising, you know. But, you know, I don't want my kids to be sheltered. I don't want them to be gun shy. If somebody says a cuss word in front of them, like, I don't want them wincing or anything like that. Like, which is one of the main things, man. When some of this stuff, you know, you're talking about earlier, you know, about protecting our kids, right? Like, there's a thing called the Warrior Poet Society in the sky on there. It's like a platform. It's really cool. Like, I'm into guns and stuff, so there's a lot of gun training and stuff on there, but there's also a thing called the Rule of Man. I think that's what it's called, but I can't remember the guy's name exactly. John Lovell's the guy that kind of runs it and stuff, but there's a lot of stuff on there about parenting, which is really cool to me, because there's, you know, you can find parenting books for but not necessarily for our way of thinking.
Yeah.
True. You know what I'm saying? Where you're raising, I'm not raising a little boy, and I'm not necessarily raising a man. I'm trying to raise a king. I want to raise somebody. In our society these days, I feel like we need to raise leaders. You know, there's something about having the capacity to be led by God and God only. You know what I mean? And outside of that, like, I want my son to be the person that kind of takes the reins in the situation. And
we're in a society where we're being demasculated all the freaking time.
Buddy, I'm telling you, it's wild to me. So much so, and my wife is more than on board with this. To be honest with you, my wife came to me a few years ago. And, you know, it's when, you know, we're watching. I think one of the conversations it came from is, you know, somebody sent me a video from social media. You know, I get them in text. I can watch them on my text. But this guy that went to a school board meeting with this book that, you know, his kid had got from the library, and then sent me another one where, you know, a teacher had done something, you know, exposed a kid to something at a very young age that the father didn't think was appropriate. And I told my wife, I said, look, you know me and you know my temperament. If I go to a school board meeting, it ain't going to be to talk to nobody. You know, it's because I know there's a few of them in the same fucking place at the same time. we're going to have a conversation. But more than that, so my wife came to me and she said, you know, with some of the things going on in public school, you know, we felt like they were being, and again, I believe in exposure, but I think there's a time, and you know, you talked about protecting innocence, like we're exposed to these. There's some folks exposing kids to some pretty wild shit.
It's called grooming.
Yeah, right?
It's a bunch of crap.
So she comes to me with this idea, and you know, she had researched it and done a lot of homework on it, and it's like a homeschool school. Like a
we homeschooled ours. When they got to about fifth grade, we pulled them out of school.
See, I was dead set against it.
But when I grew up, homeschool kids were like either Christian nutbags. You know, they were really weird. They were unsocialized. Things are different now. I mean, yeah. You have a lot of resources. When we left, we took our kids out of school. We left with a group of about five families, and that's the first year or so we had this collective group. And one was an old English teacher, and she knew Spanish. My wife was a nurse. We had people that have different disciplines, and so we kind of collectively did that. And then we found another situation where they went to a church where they actually went to class on Friday. And then they had access to sports and different things, but they did most of their studies and curriculum at home throughout the week. And then, nice. So it was. There's some different things out there now that make it much more appealing. You don't have to deal with that crap.
Yeah, she came to me, and I'm just to be completely transparent and honest. Like I really wasn't hearing it. I was stubborn enough to be like, nope. They can go to school where I went to school or where you went to school. You know, she went to Commerce, I went to Jefferson. My wife and I have a long history. We went about 6-7 years without seeing or speaking to each other. But we had a past before that. I met her. I was working on some community service hours at a church. And that was the church her family went to. But, you know, that was the most heated rivalry in the state of Georgia when it came to single-A football. You weren't allowed to date across the river. You know, but I kind of came to terms with it. I was like, listen, you know, our school, the school I went to, I graduated with 66. Now there's 66 in one classroom. You know, it blew up. Commerce is still small considering. But I said, they can go to where I went to school or where you went to school, if I could wrap my mind around that, you know. But we're not doing any of that. Our kids aren't going to be socially awkward. We're not doing that. And to be honest with you, you know, watching a couple of those videos and then the Uvalde thing in particular, you know, we're wondering why these schools are getting hit, man. It's like, you know, not to get into a gun conversation, but, you know, it's a soft target. You got a couple police resource officers at the very most. Like, it's easier to get in a school than it is to get on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't like that concept. I didn't like, you know, I didn't agree with a lot of what, you know, these schools are exposing these kids to. And when the Uvalde thing happened, I really did. I was like, you know what, let's have the conversation. And she I got to give her all the credit in the world. I had a couple things. I was like, I'm cool with it, but they're going to have to spend some time outside learning how to do shit that's self-sustaining. They need to learn how to plant things that, you know, they can eat if they need to. They need to learn how to fish. You know, they need to learn how to hunt, you know, at some point. Maybe we can't teach kids hunting quite yet, but you know what I mean? Like, I ain't let one my own, but, you know, as far as, like, plant stuff, fishing, like, I feel like that's important. And I said, and also, you know, I want them to learn history. I have a 16-year-old godson that didn't know who Hitler was. Like, you know, history repeats itself in the worst way, you know, especially if we're ignorant to it. You know, it's like we're really concerned about showing these kids, exposing these kids on, you know, algorithms that are literally built to kind of make you a sheep. I don't like that train of thought at all. You
well,
know?
They're not. They're being programmed. They're not being taught. They're being programmed because they're not being educated in a way that promotes independent thought and rationalization and problem solving and those things. That's what's being taken out of the school in a large chunk.
Yeah, born into conflict. Yeah. We'll teach you real quick how to argue.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean. We'll teach you real quick how to walk out when something you don't even understand is going on, you know. So she brought the idea to the table, and man, now we're in her first year. She picked up several more kids for the second semester, but she started this thing called Art Learning Academy. It's faith-based. It's like a micro school, kind of like a homeschool school. Man, I'm not going to lie to you. I sent the teachers to pistol training. You know, if that's one school, somebody shows up to hit it. I don't know if they're going to hit anybody, but they're going to get shot back at least, at the very least, you know. Exactly. But, you know, I have to give her a ton of credit, man. My wife's an extremely faithful woman, but she's an incredible mom. And she decided to do something and took off with it. And, man, it really is like some of these kids – it's the first time I've ever heard of kids crying because they didn't get to go to school, you know, on a certain day. I was quite the opposite. Man, I was trying to dodge that motherfucker every time I got a chance, bro. If I could have been sick every day, I would have been, you know. But, you know, it was kind of going out on a limb, and I know there's a lot of folks probably listening to this, but, you know, they won't agree with that, and that's fine. Somebody disagreeing with me doesn't bother me at all. But, you know, I can honestly say that, you know, that school's something that's, I feel like it's a service to the community.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we're giving kids a safe place to go learn. And also it's like and there are other positive things to it too. Like classroom sizes being so small, you know, she did some research, was explaining to me that it's, you know, a lot of these schools, you got people that are way ahead and people that are way behind.
And they pull the head back because instead of removing the way behind and giving them or putting a class back or whatever, they pull everybody back. They don't reward you for excelling. They penalize you and drag you back to wait on everybody else.
Yeah. And you know what? You know, when we looked into it, it's not necessarily on the teacher because the teacher has to teach the curriculum and to the large part of the class. It's like, you know, with a smaller class size, yeah, they're able to be more direct and you know, have a more one-on-one approach and kind of keep them right there together. It's not so much, you know, about, you know, the kid having a learning disability. It's just being able to cater to the way they do learn.
And everybody learns different.
Yeah, absolutely.
We all do.
So, it's been something I'm extremely proud of her for. And, you know, I know a lot of people look at it and go, you know, but anyway, it's something I'm extremely proud of her for, and I truly do believe, you know, now it's not just our household. Like, we're kind of taking that mentality into our community, and you know, the church that my wife got me back into church here recently, we actually, you know, I went and I kind of had my feelings about it, you know, but. I can honestly say I've seen some positive changes in my life, and I'm to the point now where I don't mind going at all, and I actually stay awake and everything, for the most part.
Dude, it's amazing to hear your journey and where you've kind of come to after all you've been through. I have much respect for you, for your career, the man that you are. Yeah. And I appreciate the candid conversation, man. I've really enjoyed this today. It's really a pleasure.
Absolutely, to meet
you, man. Boys, y'all got any questions before we get out of here? I know they always got something.
Don't be shy.
Scott works on a question leading up to these things.
This one's kind of weird, but okay. If you're in two lanes, you're going that way, and you get a sign that says one your lane's ending. Do you move over quickly, or do you go on to the end and then work your way in, zipper in, as they say?
I think it depends on what's beside me. You know, if it's a fucking 18-wheeler with a bunch of pipe on the back of it, I may let him go on ahead. You know what I mean?
That, it might
if
depend on what you're driving, too.
Subaru, she might have to eat some decent gas, right? You know what I'm saying?
I like it.
Sorry. I got a train horn on my new truck, bro. I'm excited about it. It's freaking awesome. It's already got me in trouble, but it's awesome.
I've seen that thing scare the shit out of people. Dude. Lord have mercy.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
I'm going to recycle one. This is pretty good. So what's an insult? Let me tell you my answer first. But what's an insult that you've received you're the most proud of? So our band leader told me that I tune like old people fuck. So I'm assuming he means slowly and with precision.
Damn, I ain't got one that can touch that shit, bro. You've had a minute to think about this shit. It's unfair.
All right, so check this. That Hank Jr. show where he's all hammered drunk. So my favorite line from that would be that South Alabama to South Alabama, something, something, something. Who gives a shit, land? So, so what would be your favorite line from that if you can think of one? The Garth part?
Yeah.
Bro, here's the thing. I'm a Garth Brooks fan. Like, Garth has some serious, there's no denying Garth Brooks or the talent that man had. But just the pure fucking nutsack on that guy and the audacity to go, oh, I remember hearing that and being like, holy shit. Like, just that is, oh my, that's a whole nother level, bro.
And he don't give a shit.
I mean, and I love that, dude. What? Who falls off a fucking mountain, destroys their whole fucking head, and then comes back and still takes the world over? You know what I mean? There's just so much about that dude that I want to learn. Well, that Rhett Akins story is so funny. It's like, you'd have to hear Rhett tell it, but he said it. He got Hank's number, and that was, man, he said it was, man, one of the coolest things that ever happened to me. I got Hank's number, and, you know, I wasn't going to call him. And, you know, it was the coolest thing ever. He said, but I got to drinking one night. Me and a couple of buddies was out riding around listening to damn Hank Jr. on the radio, and he said, I got up the drunken courage to call him. And he said he called him and said he hello. And he said, Hank, it's Red Akins. I got your number the other night. And he said, who? He said, Red Akins. It doesn't matter, man. Do you know how many people are riding around listening to your songs on dirt roads right now? And he goes, millions, brother. And hung up on him. Millions, brother. Dude, I'm telling you, man, that's a fucking trip. Yeah, I can't even touch that. I don't know the answer to the question.
I think that's where we have to end the show, boys.
Dude, I'm telling you, man.
Brother, it's been a pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine, man. I'm telling you, I mean this, I'm not just saying this because I'm in your house talking to you, man. Your time, you came up amongst monsters, man, and not only held your own, but did amazing things for the genre. And, you know, you got some of my favorite songs of all time. So, man, to be able to sit down and have a conversation with you, and for y'all to think to have me and invite me, man, this is something I'll never forget, brother. I appreciate you more than you know.
I hope we get to share the stage somewhere along the way in the near future.
Let's do it.
And at some point, let's sit down and do this again, my friend.
I'm all the way
in. I will call you a friend from now on out, man.
You and me both.
Much respect, brother. Yeah. Brantley Gilbert. Yeah, baby.